On this episode of Skeptico,
why is consciousness important to social science?
Well, not everybody would say that it is. I think actually most of my colleagues ignore consciousness or just take it for granted. On the other hand, I do think that it is implicit in almost all explanations that social scientists come up with.
What are some of the ways in which these assumptions about consciousness are implicit in the assumptions we're making when we look at political groups or the social sciences in general?
Well, the key argument that I make is that anything that has to do with the mind, that has to do with intentional phenomena, beliefs, desires, even the unconscious, all of those intentional phenomena, and some philosophers would argue this, imply consciousness. And in the social world, if you think about the kinds of things social scientists are interested in, like states, for example, in my own field of international relations, these are collective intentional phenomena. These are collective states of mind. They have no sort of material existence out there. You can't see them from space or anything. And so they're all sort of implicated or dependent upon us being conscious as well. Put it a different way, if human beings were just robots with no consciousness, I don't think we would have intentional states of mind. We wouldn't have minds at all. And there wouldn't be states. There wouldn't be corporations or churches or anything like that either.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, I couldn't help but think back to my days in graduate school. I had graduated college, and then I went and worked for a few years, and then I went back to graduate school. I was at the University of Arizona pursuing a PhD, and this really cool thing called artificial intelligence was really happening, and I wanted to be a part of that, and I was studying for that. And I remember my buddy and fellow PhD candidate, Øystein, this guy from Norway who I'd met, who I immediately realized was a lot smarter than me and a lot better programmer than me. So I kind of latched onto him and figured I'd try and get through this thing together because we both wanted to put together our own program in artificial intelligence. So the next thing you know, Øystein and I found ourselves in the psychology department sitting in a class on cognitive psychology. And I was in the role of observer sitting back as Øystein was just captivating the crowd with this interdisciplinary talk about the latest models in computer science. And the cognitive psychology people were eating this stuff up because they realized that a lot of their models in cognitive psychology were based on computer models, you know, long-term memory, short-term memory, accessing memory, all that stuff. So they were eager to find out what was going on in computer science that maybe they didn't know about. And it always stayed with me, the power of an interdisciplinary approach. And that very much relates to today's guest, Dr. Alexander Wendt from The Ohio State University, and what he's done in his book, Quantum Mind and the Social Sciences. This was a super fun dialogue to have with someone who I greatly respect and admire. This interview isn't very long because I wanted to reserve some time to really tackle a whole other subject that Dr. Wendt has written about, and that will be upcoming in another episode of Skeptico, but I just have to leave that out there as kind of a tease, and we'll get to that next time. But for now, I hope you enjoy this dialogue with Dr. Alexander Wendt about the implications for quantum consciousness on the social sciences. Today we welcome Ohio State University political science professor Dr. Alexander Wendt to Skeptico. Alex is one of the world's most highly respected and influential experts in the field of international relations. So you might be asking, what is he doing on a show about consciousness science? But Dr. Wendt has also just recently published a book, Quantum Mind and Social Science, Unifying Physical and Social Ontology. So there's quite an interesting overlap, actually, between his work and the topics we talk about so much here. So it's very nice to have you on, Dr. Wendt. Thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Absolutely.
So this latest book of yours is another groundbreaking effort in your field, and you've kind of become known for doing that kind of stuff, turning everything in your field upside down. But what you've done here is you've taken this idea of scientific materialism, this idea, as I often say, that we're all biological robots in a meaningless universe, and you've said, okay, since a lot of people are saying that that might be falsified, that the reductionistic, materialistic model might actually be falsified, then you're saying, okay, what might that mean for the social sciences if we look past that model? Is that a fair assessment of what you're doing with this book?
Yeah, I'm focused on implications for social science, but I think actually the implications go much more broadly to, you know, implications for our understanding of the mind in general, our place in the universe, and so on, although I'm not addressing those things systematically in the book. I'm mainly focusing on the implications on the social side. But yes, that is a fair statement.
And actually, I thought that was terrific to bring your considerable expertise and knowledge and just ability to kind of sort things out in the political science and in the social sciences in general, and use that lens and say, okay, how might this impact us over here? And it's really stunning what you come up with. So let's focus on that and start with, maybe from the beginning, why is consciousness important to social science?
Well, not everybody would say that it is. I think actually most of my colleagues ignore consciousness or just take it for granted, and would say that it doesn't necessarily add anything to the kinds of explanations that social scientists typically develop. On the other hand, I do think that it is implicit in almost all explanations that social scientists come up with. And so if it is inconsistent with the larger worldview that we're operating under, namely the standard materialist view, if consciousness is actually inconsistent with that, that's a problem for social science, because that means any explanations that social scientists come up with that imply consciousness or depend on consciousness are called into question, I think.
Right. And let's go back for a second to that first point, because that's really the crux of it in a lot of ways. And it's so fascinating, is it's implicit. And you break that down in some really interesting ways. In what are some of the ways in which these assumptions about consciousness are implicit in the assumptions we're making when we look at political groups or the social sciences in general?
Well, the key argument that I make, and it is kind of an assertion, I can't prove it, but it is an assertion I think that is fairly intuitive, is that anything that has to do with the mind, that has to do with intentional phenomena, beliefs, desires, even the unconscious, that all of those intentional phenomena, and some philosophers would argue this, imply consciousness. And in the social world, if you think about the kinds of things social scientists are interested in, like states, for example, in my own field of international relations, these are collective intentional phenomena. These are collective states of mind. They have no sort of material existence out there. You can't see them from space or anything. And so they're all sort of implicated or dependent upon us being conscious as well. Put it a different way, if human beings were just robots with no consciousness, I don't think we would have intentional states of mind. We wouldn't have minds at all. And there wouldn't be states. There wouldn't be corporations or churches or anything like that either.
And what I hear you saying is, when we jump over to the political science field, we just assume that are not deterministic. They have somewhat of a free will or a collective consciousness. I thought that was interesting in your book. You point out this mismatch between some of the assumptions we're making about how states operate and how groups operate versus the classical model of the assumptions we're making about how individual consciousness might work inside of a human being.
I guess I would want to separate out the free will question, which is also part of the argument of the book, but I think that's a separate issue, and also the whole issue of collective consciousness, which is something I wrestle with at the end of the book, and I'm not sure I'm satisfied with my own take on it. I guess all I would want to make the case for right now is that it is widely accepted in the social sciences that any kind of group-level social phenomena like states or social systems are what are usually called collective intentions, collective beliefs. And I would argue that any kind of collective belief like that implies consciousness, and that robots could not have collective beliefs. And so robots could not have states and so on. Now, whether that implies some kind of collective consciousness, where the state itself has some kind of consciousness, that's a harder argument to make, a separate argument. But, you know, that's, I think, also something I personally believe and I try to make the case for at the end of the book.
Sure. But again, I'm going to, maybe I'm battering on this point too hard, but I'd bring you back to the first one, because I think it's just, it was eye-opening to me to say, of course we believe that part of a state identity is a set of beliefs. And yet when we juxtapose that with the classical model of consciousness, we say, well, you know, beliefs are, we have a different understanding of what beliefs mean when we jump over to the social sciences than a very strict reading of it in the classical model.
Yes, that's certainly true. I think if in the classical materialist view, beliefs are just brain states, basically. And what the materialists have wrestled with, and in my view, utterly failed to solve, is how you get from brain states to mental states or conscious states. And the stuff that social scientists are interested in, we're not interested in brain states, we're interested in mental states. And if your ontology can't accommodate mental states, that's a big problem, it seems to me, for social science in general and for our worldview more broadly.
Let me just touch on a couple of other social science topics, because, again, maybe my perspective is different. In reading your book, I feel like I'm entering a whole new world, you know, so this stuff that is probably very standard, ordinary stuff for you is fascinating to me. But
well, I think for most social scientists in practice, they don't worry about free will and determinism, because almost all social scientific models and experimental results are statistical anyway, probabilistic. So that could be because human beings have free will, or it could be because our models are just not very good or the data are not very good. Either way, we don't have to worry about free will. But it seems to me, if you really think about it, most social scientists, or many of them anyway, one reason we do social science is to enhance human agency and to sort of empower human beings to solve problems by helping us understand what's going on around us and then thereby empower us to make changes. So there's an implicit assumption, again, I think, that human beings do have free will. If we didn't have free will, why bother doing social science, I guess would be my view. And I think from the classical perspective, you know, there are arguments that classical determinism is compatible with free will in some sense, and that's a long-standing debate that I sort of talk about briefly in the book. My own view is that a quantum perspective provides a much more natural foundation for an assumption of free will. And I would also point out, of course, that in the law, all legal systems assume people have free will, and moral responsibility in general depends on free will. So it seems to me free will is deeply embedded in our intuitive sense of who we are. It's deeply embedded in our own experience of ourselves, and a worldview that can't accommodate that is, to me, just sort of just prima facie intuitively, there's a problem. It's a mistake. And so I'm trying to kind of provide an alternative basis for thinking about free will in the social world.
Right, and I think there's a lot of advantages in making it explicit in the way that you do, in drawing it out and saying, okay, this is just kind of an implicit assumption, but what does it mean when you draw it out? Let me touch on one other one, and then I'll kind of move off this general topic, but this idea of non-separability versus locality. And so, obviously, when we jump over in the quantum world, we have a whole different understanding of what it means to be non-local and how counterintuitive that is. But then you draw some interesting parallels in what that might mean for the social sciences.
Yes. I mean, I think actually in the social world, non-locality and non-separability makes perfect sense. It's actually quite intuitive. And the standard example that, you know, many graduate students will learn very early on is the master-slave dialectic in Hegel or whatever. You know, you can't be a master without a slave and vice versa. So there's an entanglement there, a non-separability of the two identities. And that's not to say that the body of the person who is the master and the body of the person who is a slave can't be separated, because clearly they're separate biological bodies, but their identity as master and slave are not separable. So they're sort of non-locally connected. So I think in the social world, it makes perfect sense to talk this way, and we do this all the time. It's sort of an implicit assumption of a lot of social scientific work. It's only in physics where it becomes much harder to make sense of it, because they're not talking about anything mental or intentional. It's just purely material systems. So this is a case, I think, where social science, in a way, provides some guidance to physicists, in a way, that this non-locality, non-separability idea actually makes perfect sense. It makes sense of our actual experience of the real world in the social domain.
I wonder about that last part, whether the social sciences can really inform our understanding of non-locality, or whether they're just operating with the shut up and calculate model, which is, you know, I love the story about shut up and calculate in the quantum physics model. And I don't remember, did you cover that in your book at all?
I don't think so. There's sort of indirect references to that kind of thinking, but I don't think I specifically used that phrase.
The shut up and calculate story is, of course, that back in the early 1900s, when all the leading quantum physicists were saying, okay, that's it. It's all about consciousness. And then their colleagues on the other side were saying, wait a minute, why do we want to enter into that whole philosophical debate and the issues of spirituality and God and all these other questions that immediately come up when we go that path? Just shut up and calculate. Use these theories to see what we can do and what we can build and what we can engineer. And we built the technology that we now live with through that kind of shut up and calculate model. But I think sometimes in the process we forget that we just kind of sidestep the real deeper philosophical issues of what it means to be non-local, what it means to be connected at that level, what it means to be more than biological robot in a meaningless universe. So I just wonder if the social sciences have really grappled with that, or whether they're just kind of doing the shut up and calculate thing, like, hey, this works, let's just continue down our probability models here because they seem to be getting us someplace. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think a couple things. I mean, I think the shut up and calculate mentality, my brother is a physicist, as I mentioned in the book, and that's very much his view, that, you know, so physics, that's what it's for, is to calculate things and to make things, and that's great, and I understand that. And clearly it's had tremendous technological result as by that kind of thinking. But I totally agree with you that there are these latent philosophical issues that have never really been solved. And I think by sort of bringing the whole physics discussion into the social domain, it makes those philosophical issues much more salient. It brings them to the fore, in a sense. Certainly, most social scientists are also not interested in the philosophy of science, philosophy of mind. They're in the shut up and calculate mode also. Of course, the calculations they're doing are all classical and not quantum. And it turns out, as I discuss, I think, in Chapter 8 about quantum decision theory, the model social scientists have built on that shut-up-and-calculate approach actually don't predict behavior as well as a quantum versions of those models do. So if we're going to calculate, let's at least calculate with quantum probability theory and not classical probability theory. So that would be sort of one implication if we're just going to stay on that sort of train of thinking. But I do think that the social context brings the philosophical stuff, makes it harder to avoid, because if the implication of a materialist worldview is that consciousness is an illusion and that free will is an illusion, well, then social scientists have got to change a lot of their fundamental practices, because a lot of our models assume consciousness and they assume free will. And I just don't think you can do social science without making those assumptions.
Right. Excellent point. So, to a certain extent, by drawing quantum consciousness model into the social sciences, you're kind of forcing a choice there, right? You're saying, okay, accept this or fully accept what it means to be this biological robot in a meaningless universe with no free will, no emotions, no experience even, right? Because you don't really have experience in the classical model, you just have the illusion of experience. Everything is an illusion. So you're kind of forcing their hand in a way, aren't you?
Yeah, see, that's, I like the way you put that. I hadn't thought of thinking of it that way, but it is trying to force a choice because, you know, there are now all these quantum decision theory people, many of whom are mathematical psychologists, and they're advancing their work very successfully, but they too do not want to get into the philosophical questions. They just want to shut up and calculate, and that's working well, and I make good use of their work. But I think they too in the end have to choose, because either we are quantum systems and consciousness is quantum mechanical, or we're not. And if we're not, and then it is all an illusion, then I think we've got a big, big problem in social science. So at the end of the day, I think, you know, it is one or the other. And actually, I was telling a colleague of mine recently that this is the first thing I've written in my career, 25 years now, that I think is either true or false. You know, hardly any social science would one use those terms, but the argument in this book is it's either right or it's wrong. And so it was kind of, in a way, a relief in a way to kind of come to that realization.
That kind of closure, huh? So where do you think this work is going to go in your field, Dr. Wendt? What, I'm sure it's stirring up a lot of interesting debates. I saw one on the internet that, if that's any indication, I don't think you're going to have any problems because it was just a totally one-sided affair, in my opinion. But what is this stirring up among your colleagues, and where do you think this is heading in terms of where this work might lead?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, it's only been a few months out, and it came out essentially over the summer, and so I think there hasn't been a lot of reaction, at least that I've seen. And I think that social scientists in general have, almost none of them know anything about quantum physics. Not that I know very much, but at least I have enough now to have written the book. So the whole worldview of quantum physics is very alien, in a sense, even though I think it's, when you think about it, quite intuitive. I think it's going to take a while for this book to, if it is going to penetrate social scientific consciousness, so to speak, it's going to take a while.
Maybe it won't. Is that what you're saying? I mean, there's a chance that even though it may seem brilliant to a small number of people, it won't penetrate the fortress that is the social sciences. I guess that's a possibility, huh?
I think it is a possibility. On the other hand, what gives me hope is, on the one hand, I think that in philosophy itself, philosophy of mind, the materialists are more and more on the defensive. They're in disarray. Their own position is internally divided. They can't agree amongst themselves about where consciousness comes from. You know, the panpsychists are gaining ground among philosophers of mind. So there's a lot of disarray on the opposing side. And on the quantum side, in social science, I think quantum decision theory and quantum game theory are going to get more and more traction, because they predict behavior that are well-known behavioral patterns in human beings very well compared to the classical model. And those kinds of experimental results with the modeling to back it up will get people's attention. And I'm actually starting a paper with a couple of my colleagues, three colleagues actually, on kind of quantum game theory and how quantum game theory can integrate political psychology and game theory, traditional game theory, and sort of on a quantum basis. And we're hoping that will sort of help people see the connections to make. But it's going to take a while, I think, and you will see what the reviews are out. I haven't seen any reviews of the book, you know, actual book reviews yet. There are a couple symposia that are in the works to which I'll write responses, but I haven't seen any of those papers yet. So it's going to take a while. But I think in the long run, my own feeling is that the classical materialist view is clearly wrong. They've had 3.5 centuries to make the case, and they're at a dead end, I think. And so that will encourage, hopefully, young people at least to take this kind of argument seriously. I think one barrier, though, is that it will require social scientists to learn new methods, new kinds of statistics, namely quantum statistics, quantum methods, which none of us is trained in. And that's going to require a lot of effort among grad students, basically, ability to sort of retool, in effect, or learn new tools that then can be applied to actual empirical kinds of work.
Yeah, change is always hard. You know, it's interesting what you say about your assessment that the reductionist materialist model is in disarray, and I certainly agree, and it's been more or less the focal point of this show over almost 300 episodes. And I guess that leads into a question that I had, and it's a frequent debate on this show, although it's somewhat of a subtle debate in a lot of ways, and that's, does the quantum model of consciousness go far enough? It seems to me that this quantum consciousness model is essentially a fallback position. There wasn't any breakthrough, other than maybe 100 years ago, that led people to quantum consciousness. It was more of a slow drip of observable phenomena that just didn't fit. So, you know, placebo effect, drip, hypnosis, drip, self-directed neuroplasticity, drip, drip, telepathy inside, drip, near-death experience, drip, drip, drip. You know, there's all this phenomena out there that starts piling up on the edges that doesn't fit. And it sometimes feels to me that the quantum model is a comfortable middle ground that a lot of people, after they've given up on materialism, and I don't think this is your position, but where they wind up, as opposed to, I mean, consciousness is fundamental model, I guess would be the other possible model that's out there that, in my estimation, and talking to a lot of folks, just seems to fit the data a lot better. I mean, the quantum consciousness model is okay for some of the data. The consciousness is fundamental, although it's more radical of a model, really has a better chance of fitting all the data. You've really dug into this. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's interesting, and I guess it depends on what you mean by consciousness is fundamental. I mean, I think in the book, I take kind of a panpsychist, neutral monist position, which in a sense makes consciousness, if not fundamental, at least kind of co-fundamental or emergent along with matter from something that is neither mind nor matter. So that's pretty close to saying it's fundamental. I guess where I would balk is saying that consciousness is first and then matter is second, which would be a more traditional idealist position. But I totally agree with you that there are a lot of anomalous phenomena out there. Some more anomalous are taken seriously than others, that can all be all need to be somehow unified. And whether it's the kind of Hameroff style quantum consciousness model or something a little more radical, whatever that might look like, I think it's going to be something in this general direction. And the anomalies are piling up. And I think, you know, there's very interesting work on sort of quantum parapsychology, which, you know, has its own problems of replication and so on. But it seems to me that that's another direction or another place where this kind of argument might have something to say. So I very much share your feeling that whether it's fundamental or not, I don't know, but certainly the virtue or part of the attraction of this whole approach to me is precisely its ability to unify things into one simple account. Things that are otherwise completely either anomalous, hard to explain, or must be dismissed.
Right. I hear where you're coming from. I think that's well said. I'll just drill into this a little more and give you a chance if you want to comment it or not. But, I mean, if you take, like, Dr. Stuart Hameroff from the University of Arizona, brilliant guy, been a guest on this show, really like him. But if you take his work in terms of quantum consciousness and then you say, okay, Stuart, what are we going to do with this near-death experience? Well, it gets kind of clumsy. It's like, well, you know, if we have this non-local here, then maybe it could be non. And then you say, but wait a minute, Stuart, what we're observing is individuated consciousness experience that is without a brain. And yet it is this individuated, you know, still an individual, more or less intact, like we think of it, with these enhanced abilities, and all that's happening without a brain. And you go, you really have to start stretching the model of this kind of quantum consciousness thing. And it's kind of easier to jump on the other side. And even if we don't know completely a model that says, okay, somehow from this consciousness field, everything is emerging. And even though that's not a very good description, it's a starting point that gives us a better chance of wrapping our arms around more phenomena. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I think the NDE experience is very interesting. You know, I follow that literature a little bit at a distance, and but I do take it seriously. I think it's something that can't be simply dismissed. And I do think that it may be that the Hameroff model or the other models that are on a similar kind of level, so to speak, can't really come to grips with that experience directly. But I guess where I might try to split the difference would be to say that even if the Hameroff-style model, which does seem to tie consciousness to a brain or something, some material, individuated material matter, that even if that's unable to explain the NDEs per se, that kind of argument, the Hameroff-style argument, will be a piece of whatever the correct explanation for NDEs is. So whether it's an underlying quantum field argument or consciousness as a field or something like that, or the universe as conscious or something like that, from which all of us are emerging constantly, then the Hameroff story will be probably a part of that larger picture, even if it can't deal with the NDE experience by itself.
Great. Well said. Very well said. So, Dr. Wendt, you mentioned that the book is newly out and is gaining some momentum now. What are your plans for talks, lectures, anything like that that people might find, and where can they find out more about this book and your larger work in general?
Well, I don't have any plans for other talks. I gave a talk up at Oberlin College a couple weeks ago. That's the first time that I was invited to present this material. I think I'll be surprised if I get many invitations of the traditional academic type to come, you know, give a talk at our department on this, because the stuff is so out there and, you know, so many people are just wary of it. So there probably won't be a lot of traditional academic talks. There are these two or three symposia that people are putting together for journals. They'll have four or five, six critiques of the book and then my response. And those will probably take, they'll probably be out next year sometime. I've been encouraged to blog about this. I've never blogged before, so I've hesitated to do that. But if I can find an angle that works for a blog, then I might do that. But I'm just sort of going to wait and see what kind of reaction the book generates. And it might fall flat. You know, it's not an IR book. It falls between cracks, between the stools, whatever. But it is very interdisciplinary. And I've had a number of emails from people in different disciplines and around the world saying, you know, what a cool book, love the book, that kind of thing. But it remains to be seen, I think, how much attention it will get and therefore what my attitude is going to be. You know, I do have this one paper that I mentioned a minute ago planned. That'll take a few months to write it, probably. But this is going to be a very slow burn, I think. It's going to take a while. And my own approach is going to be slow as a result, I think.
It must be hard to imagine that this might be one of those books that 15 years from now, some grad student discovers and then turns into, you know, a much more famous account
right.
of kind of what's going on. That could happen, I guess. So, terrific. It's been great talking to you. Stick around if you have a few more minutes and
sure.
We'll talk about this other topic, but I'll wrap this up with another thank you for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me. It's always fun to talk about these things, and you know, I will welcome emails from anybody. If anybody has any comments or suggestions, I'd love to hear them. So,
thanks again to Dr. Alexander Wendt for joining me today on Skeptico. I have one question I guess I tee up from this interview, and that is, what do you make of Dr. Wendt's assertion that the social sciences are built on this implied assumption of materialism? Do you think that's really true? Do you think it matters to the extent that he thinks it matters? Or are the social sciences and international relations and political science just fine the way they are, without a need for retooling with the end of materialism? Let me know your thoughts on that. Of course, a place to do it is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. From there, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes or Stitcher or You can also from there jump over to the forum and join in the discussion there, or leave a comment or shoot me a note on Facebook or any other way you'd like to connect with me. I did mention in this show that I did a follow-up interview with Dr. Wendt. It's going to be very interesting. It's on a purely political science topic, and it's kind of on a New World Order kind of thing that he's written on that is very influential in his field. And I think I have a nice interview lined up with that, so I'm excited to do that. I'm excited to do a number of other projects here on Skeptical. I have a number of balls in the air. It's just so much fun. I never stop having fun doing this work. I do hope you enjoy it. I know that many of you do, and I hear from you. And I'm always excited to get those emails and hear what people are thinking about the show and how they're using it. And as I've mentioned previously, if you have ideas for the show that you would like to implement, i.e. interviews that you would like to do or articles you would like to publish on Skeptico, please let me know. I'm happy to discuss that with you and see if it's a good fit. And if it is, we'll find a way to get it out through the Skeptico website or even on the Skeptico podcast. Well, I guess that's all for this episode of Skeptico. Please join me again next time. And until that next time, take care and bye for now.